Infrastructure. 5 hours after Team Uno embarked on their exploration to find a source of food and water, people began getting agitated and started complaining among themselves about the situation. Using the new title of General Leader, Joe tried to rally the people together, leaning on the romantic charms of exploration to gather persons for labor work and persons with combat, military, or hunting experience. Joe then made an odd request that everyone remove and put away one clean article of clothes, then stressed that he needed 3 groups of willing working people to ensure everyone's survival. As the other generals listened, Joe went on to mention that he needed a group responsible for creating the necessary tools for building and survival, such as axes, knives, spears, hammers, small bowls, and ropes. Once the tools are made, Joe made it clear that the majority of the labor workers will be gathering and providing the raw resources involved in constructing basic shelters and fires. Because these tools have a short shelf life, Joe made sure to have a maintenance group to replace damaged tools and craft rope. The last group was the defense team to watch over workers when they went out gathering resources from wild animals. When Joe was done, he dismissed the people, and they immediately started gathering all the stones in the surrounding field, along with any pieces of wood they could find. Before long, they made enough stone tools to put a factory out of business. The tools weren't perfect at first, but with every build and personal review, they got better, and so did the labor workers. After seeing Joe take charge, Jemski wanted to live up to his title as General Leader, and gathered 50 engineers to form a team to create a layout for the settlement. This team would be responsible for the placement of structures and common areas. Back on Earth, Jemski was an urban designer after serving in the Army for 7 years. In no time, Jemski and the team came up with a simple design that the other two generals were quick to approve of. Plus, the layout was future-proof, making it easy for them to upgrade when technology got developed or if it was time to expand. The location could have been better, especially since there wasn't any access to water. But it was, for the most part, safe. While developing the details, it couldn't be helped that these city planners' first instinct was to plan the roads and routes for lines of electrical wiring, sewage, and water. However, it didn't slip the engineers' minds that these designs were the bare minimum. They needed to first familiarize themselves with the local climate and environment. The housing design that felt most simple was inspired by the A-frame house built in 1934, but here on this planet, the engineers called it the triangular-shaped house, which was built off the ground on platforms. A last-minute change, Jemski added, something that Timon of the first exploration team mentioned that influenced that choice. It was easy for the team to make the settlement sustainable, their waste reduction was low, and it would be easy to keep it that way, and everything they had was environmentally friendly. Regarding the HQ design, Jemski called the Council of 30 together, and 5 of his best engineers for security reasons. The Council had been working on establishing a system of governance that was fair, transparent, and responsive to the community's needs. On the other hand, Lady V had a daunting task ahead of her, but she was determined to bring modernity to their primitive surroundings. She first requested Jemski to design her research and development area, which he agreed to do in exchange for a later favor. Lady V's team consisted of craftspeople, 10 engineers, and 30 scientists, including medical specialists. Once the land was surveyed and Lady V's building was constructed, Jemski and his team of engineers and labor workers marked out the housing blocks and roads using stones and channels. With the help of Japanese artisans Riku and Aoi, who were experts in sashimono, they efficiently constructed wooden huts without nails. In 2 days of non-stop work, rotating in groups of 250 people per building, they constructed 314 huts in total. After their 2 days of exhausting work, everyone needed a break. But the scorching heat left them dehydrated and needing water. For the past few days, Joe had them collecting morning dew with the pieces of clean garments he had them put aside on their first day, along with the crafted mud and leaf bowls to store the excess water they gathered. However, as their pieces of garments got dirty and it was getting harder to collect morning dew or water that collected in pockets of surrounding leaves, the rate at which they could work had to be decreased to secure their safety as the day went on. It was starting to become a routine for everyone: wake, hydrate, work till midday, and then relax out of the sun. And just like it would any other day, all the labor workers gathered their last bits of collected water and took refuge in the cool shade of the constructed buildings and under the nearby trees in shifts. A few hours passed, and persons were crafting while others were sleeping. Then suddenly, a loud screech shattered the tranquility. A few seconds after the screech came the sound of wolves howling in the distance deep within the forest. Without warning, a gust of wind was felt by everyone who was now standing in the mildly constructed open field. As the wind pressure cooled their weary bodies, they instinctively and collectively looked up to see a giant bird-like dinosaur flying overhead, leaving the majority of people terrified. As the massive creature soared overhead, its long, pointed beak and sharp teeth glistened in the sun as it scanned the terrain below for prey. Its wings, like a bird's but made of a thin, leathery membrane, stretched out past its wrist. With each beat of its wings, the surrounding treetops would bend to the point of breaking as the creature slowly and gracefully flew around in circles above them. As General Joe watched the giant monstrosity circle the field and then fly off into the forest, he couldn't help but worry about the safety of Team Uno. They weren't given a return deadline, but it's been 2 days since they left in search of food and water. Only a few people realized that the days on the planet were longer than Earth's by 6 hours. The world that they were living in was contained and protected by the volcano's crater. But the appearance of the monstrous flying creature was a reminder that humans were no longer at the top of the food chain. And unlike ants, they were trapped twice over by the forest with its inhabitants and the tall walls of the volcano crater. Joe: No fucking way. It's not safe out here. Will: Do you think we can bring it down and kill it for a source of food, sir? Joe: Stop talking to me before I strangle you. Did you not see what it's capable of? The force from the wings of this pterodactyl-looking monster is altering the life we're trying to build. There's no way we'll be able to defend against that creature unless we move to the forest or hills and pray for caves. Will: But sir, at this point in time, for us to just up and run to the forest after all the work we've already put in, it doesn't guarantee that we will survive. If the creature is capable of diving down while we're in the forest, breaking the trees in its path to get to its prey, then what? Plus, the animals that may lurk within the forest might do more damage to our numbers than the giant bird might. Joe: We are but mere chicken feed to this dinosaur. If we stay and it lands, it will destroy everything we've managed to construct. Fuck! What if there are more of them? I can only pray that this isn't some kind of feeding ground for them. Will: Well, sir, you got a few options. You and the other generals could have us run to the dangerous safety of the forest canopy. Or you generals could have us hide away within the huts we've built and avoid the chance of being spotted by other aerial creatures or from that other random wild animals that could come charging out of the forest at us at any moment, sir. Joe: I'm sure no animal would run out here in the open to be picked off by a predator, just like we know to avoid the open from aerial attacks. These animals probably know best how to avoid their predators, but going to the forest is definitely not an option for us right now. I can hear the animals surrounding the forest running away from the direction that the monster went. In case it comes back, we need to come up with a plan, or else push might come to shove. Feeling uneasy about the situation, General Joe called for the Council of 30 to discuss the issue of a ban on any exploration into the surrounding forest. The other generals agreed with his decision, and they left it up to the council to work out the details. Before long, word went out that it had been forbidden to enter deep into the woods. There was a speech sent out about how it was important for the group to prioritize their safety and well-being, which meant taking precautionary measures to avoid potential dangers. The council knew that exploration was necessary for survival, and it was equally important to do so cautiously. It wouldn't be sustainable to restrict the people from the forest's resources, which led to the council placing a requirement to explore the forest. Any group seeking permission to hunt or explore needs a minimum of 50 persons. Anything less would be denied. If this rule was broken, the punishment would be banishment. On day 4, Generals Joe and Lady V knew that their people wouldn't be able to function in the heat, especially since they were super dehydrated. Forming two groups of 50 for a 2-hour exploration, Joe took one group to the north to hunt for meat while Lady V went to the west looking for research material. Both groups collected similar information about the bugs and small edible plants in the forest, but a unique discovery was made by a scientist named Bulb Crane, who visited the western part of the forest. While inspecting a few fallen old trees, he noticed that they naturally contained carbon fiber. These trees also have a natural resistance to flames, but the most intriguing aspect of them was that after measuring 8 different fallen trees, Bulb found that once the pit within the trunk reaches a diameter of 12 inches, the tree clips itself at the base and falls. Bulb was aware that after the harvesting process, they would be able to craft superior hand tools and weapons. The intention was to construct a storage unit upon their return to accommodate these items along with other mineral materials. As the other generals were away, Gemsky supervised a small group of labor workers on the HQ construction project while granting the main labor workers a break till the search party returned. Gemsky, Will, where are you? Come here for a second. Will, here I am, sir. How can I help you today? Gemsky, why so formal? For a second, I almost ordered a happy meal. Your energy reminds me of a drive-thru. Will, sorry, sir. I'll try my best to be an average dick. Gemsky, woo, Willy Will. Keep that big Will energy in your pants. I just wanted to have a simple conversation with you. Can you imagine that 5 days ago, we were on Earth welcoming the new year, and I was getting my dick sucked by two crazy high on LSD demons that were swelling my gland to an eruption, son? Will. Sir. Gemsky. Sorry, you're right. Could you do me a favor, Will? Will. Anything, sir, once it's not illegal. Gemsky. Willie, my boy, everything here is legal till we establish those rules. But I want you to keep an eye on the group of star-watching scientists. I didn't personally hear it, but the word is they know something about where we are. Will. Sir? What do you mean they know something? If they did, then they would have said something. This would have been a piece of cake if we still had our implants. How advanced are the creatures that bought use here? The implants at our age have fused with our minds, so to remove them means death. But yet here we are. Some of my childhood injuries are gone, and yet I feel like I'm losing my identity because of these changes. Gemsky. Almost as if your mind is trying to reject your body. Will. Yeah, and these long days are starting to feel like short days, as if my mind is tapping into the wavelength of the rotation of the planet. Is this what they call adapting, sir? Before Gemsky could answer, the two generals emerged from the northwest part of the forest, carrying baskets and branches of fruits and bug meat. Just as they cleared the forest canopy, the sound of birds in the air screeching silenced that section of the crater, and then came a distant wind which steadily grew stronger the closer the screeches came to the settlement. Frightened and panicked, everyone rushed towards the huts for shelter. However, this time, only the three generals remained unaffected by the bird's cry. They knew what time it was, and they were well aware of the situation at hand, and as the leaders of this new world, they couldn't afford to be scared. Initially, they referred to the pterodactyl-looking dinosaur as the big monster bird, but that name just didn't have the right ring to it. After receiving reports on its size, the council settled on the name Launch Bird. As chaos ensued, some fled in a frantic panic while a few stood their ground, steering off in the direction of the screeching. As the figure in the distance emerged from the treetops, it bore a striking resemblance to a phoenix with flames dancing on its body. But what caught their attention even more was the colossal object it held in its grasp. As it flitted through the air of the open field, the creature would occasionally collide with the surrounding trees. General V, who was closely observing its actions, realized that it was attempting to extinguish the flames on its body rather than creating them. The strength of the creature's attacker in the forest was evident. Judging by the object it was carrying, it must be valuable enough for it to risk its life to attain. Despite being engulfed in flames, the launch bird was fortunate enough to have its flames extinguished by slamming itself through the trees. Suddenly, a group of 9 smaller birds emerged from the nearby trees and launched an attack on the gigantic launch bird. Were these tiny birds the cause of all this mayhem to the launch bird? General V thought. She found it perplexing that the giant bird didn't retaliate or attempt to fly higher, and she needed clarification on this matter. As the battle unfolded, these animals fought tooth and nail. With its massive wingspan, the launch bird took to the skies to shake off the smaller birds that had launched an attack. With a powerful flap of its wings, it created a gust of wind that blew the smaller birds away. But just as the giant bird thought it had gained the upper hand, some of the relentless birds locked their talons onto its skin and wings, causing it to falter mid-flight. The launch bird's eyes widened with alarm as it struggled to maintain altitude, with the smaller birds clinging onto its body. With each flap of its wings, it strained to break free from their grip. But the smaller birds were determined to succeed in their attack and held on tight, causing the launch bird to fly erratically above the open field. The sounds of screeching and flapping filled the air as these birds battled it out. The launch bird's massive form contrasted with the smaller bird's nimble movements as they darted around it, trying to find the perfect angle to strike. It was a battle of strength and endurance, and only time would tell who would come out victorious in the end. Out of nowhere, three birds broke away from the tangle of fighting birds and hovered a few feet away, biding their time. Without warning, they dived down with incredible speed, their sharp talons aimed at the six birds still clinging onto the launch bird. The sudden attack caught everyone off guard, everyone but the smaller birds that were attacked. The launch bird was struggling, frantically trying to evade the incoming assault. But it was too late. The three diving birds which delivered the devastating blows left the birds maimed. As if it was a strike of a match, the six birds exploded on their target with an intense fire which caused the air to shimmer. As the fire burned and spread along the body of the launch bird, the few who watched from below stood in amazement. Now that the smoke from the remains of the smaller birds was out of the way, the three attacking birds extended their wings and created some distance, and their attention was never wavering from the launch bird. Without any hesitation, the three birds flew back in for the attack, their talons primed and ready to strike. As the birds continued their intense battle, the object that the launch bird was clutching slipped from its grip and plummeted to the ground below. General Joe, who had been closely monitoring the situation, immediately sprang into action. He signaled to the other two generals to gather some men and prepare to retrieve the fallen object. The animals were too preoccupied with their fight to notice the humans' movements, providing an opportune moment for the retrieval team. Lady V, who had been closely watching the birds and the fearless people standing in the fields, devised a plan as Jemski called the men and women together to secure the object. She then directed the team to take it to the military headquarters, where they could study it in detail and figure out why the birds were so intent on obtaining it. If they managed to get the object to the headquarters, then she could have the object hidden deep within the foundation of the headquarters and carefully covered to avoid detection by any curious birds. With the object safely in their possession, Lady V could now focus on uncovering its secrets and using that knowledge to gain an advantage in their battle for survival. The retrieval team hurried over to the fallen object, which appeared to be a colossal jelly-like sack filled with fluid. However, upon trying to lift it, they quickly realized the futility of their efforts. It was simply too massive and bulky to move, even with a large group of people. Faced with this dilemma, they decided to take a different approach and attempted to drag the base of the plant back to their campsite. A few minutes into dragging the plant base, they discovered a new problem. Numerous thin roots had grown off the base and were now entangling their feet and making it difficult to move. Amidst the grunts and groans of the workers, complaints started to arise about the tangled roots causing additional complications. But they persevered, inching the massive sack along the ground, leaving a trail of crushed vegetation in their wake. It was slow, arduous work, but they were determined to get the object back to their base and unlock its secrets. As the retrieval team dragged the massive sack closer to their headquarters, they suddenly started to notice something strange happening. People were collapsing, some even passing out, and the air was thick with the acrid smell of decay. It was clear that something was seriously wrong. In a panic, the team rushed to the aid of their fallen comrades, only to discover that the thin roots of the plant were tightly wrapped around their limbs, breaking their skin and draining the water from their bodies. It was as if the plant was actively trying to absorb their life force. Quickly, those who had not yet been affected sprang into action, cutting the roots free from the injured and attempting to keep them awake. As General V looked at the situation around her, the birds were still fighting intensely, but the sack of jelly was driving her intuition crazy. In a display of quick thinking and leadership, General V instructed everyone who was hiding within the huts to construct large baskets capable of holding water and be ready to make an assault. If the birds are gone by sunset, take the empty baskets along with the weak and sick persons to the large gel sack and await instructions. As the launch bird crashed to the ground with a fiery breath and wounds in its wings and belly, General Joe saw an opportunity to feed the settlement for days to come. With a stone hammer in one hand and a carbon fiber spear in the other, he charged towards the weakened bird. Others joined in, wielding whatever tools they could find as makeshift weapons. It was no easy task striking at the gigantic bird, which was flailing around like a fish out of water. but they felt it necessary to take down the creature in order to sustain their community. After a grueling fight, they finally managed to halt the bird's activities, in which case General Joe didn't hesitate to call for the hunters and chefs to help clean, butcher, and prepare it as food. Joe: List up, people. This resource is a gift from Lady V's god, so we better make sure you use every part of it. The burns on the lunch bird are pretty extensive, but we can give it a few seconds to study its makeup before we dress the launch bird and then process the meat. I suggest finding a way to age them, but I'll leave the decisions to the actual skilled person in this field. There's no need to baby you, capable humans. Later that evening, the scientists who were in charge of examining the fluid-filled gel sac found that it contained no poison. In fact, it was 80% water and had vitamins and protein in the other 20% or so. Lady V, hearing the news, gave the settlers the go-ahead to fill their crafted baskets and bowls with the gel fluid and instructed them to hydrate and survive at all costs.